So today we're going to be discussing, starting our discussion of differential forms. So you learn from Giuseppe all about the tangent bundle and the cotangent bundle and the various tensor bundles, and also about tensor fields, which are sections of those bundles. So let's just talk about how differential forms look like at a particular point first. Let's define subspace on wedge K, the kth exterior power of the cotangent. And this subspace is the totally anti-symmetric tensors. So in other words, Giuseppe defined kth tensor power to be a space of multilinear maps. So I take K vectors and I get a number, and this operation must be linear in each variable. So the kth exterior power is the same thing, except that we ask it to be totally anti-symmetric. So let's call this a phi, the subspace is the collections, sorry, call that omega, or those omega such that if V1, VK are vectors, and I take any permutation, then when I permute the vectors, I pick up a sign. So actually, which reminds me, I forgot to ask maybe you guys and Giuseppe if you're familiar with this symmetric group and this alternating representation. I think they should be. Yeah, okay. So this condition is equivalent to saying when I just permute any two adjacent vectors, I pick up a sign of -1. Okay, so this is the abstract definition. Then we say on a manifold M, a K-form is just the same thing, a tensor field of type K0, the way Giuseppe defined it, except if I forget if we use K0 or 0K.
K, yes, this would be K0.
Okay. The tensor field of type K0, which is totally anti-symmetric in the sense above.
Zero K.
Okay. In other words, if you have evaluated at each point, it satisfies this condition. So, but the approach I'm going to take to this, I think I'm going to be a little more coordinate based than Giuseppe was. So let's move to seeing what this looks like in coordinates. X1, Xn, and as Giuseppe explained, the expressions Dxi form a basis for the cotangent bundle at some point. You know, these are coordinates centered. So we can ask, how do I find a basis for that space? Well, so I'm going to use the notation. Dx I one wedge dx I k. So what does this mean? This is going to be a particular element of that space. So I need to write down a particular linear map. So the linear map I'm going to write down is, it's going to take k vectors or the multilinear maps. Okay. We're going to send it to, well, dx lower I pairs with the vector the same index. So the way I'm going to pair them, I'm just going to sum over ways of pairing the I and j with this. Delta I one, a sigma one, delta k. Okay. So I hope this notation isn't a bit too dense. Alternatively, you can think of this expression as the anti-symmetrization of this tensor. And I think in Giuseppe's notation for tensors, this would have been something familiar, right? Yes. That's all we're doing. We're saying, okay, differential forms are anti-symmetric tensors. I just take the obvious things and I anti-symmetrize. That's my basis. Well, we have to think a little bit about because I'm anti-symmetrizing, dx1, dx2 is the same as minus dx2, dx1. So there's going to be some redundancy in this description. So let's think about the redundancy. hell? We take two things in the middle. That's minus the same expression, or I've switched them. So if you think a little bit about this, what this tells you is by using this rule, where if I switch to adjacent things, I pick up a sign, I can always assume that the indices are ordered. Basis. Is dx by 1 wedge dx by k, where these are strictly increasing. Because if they weren't strictly increasing, I could just switch them around until they were. And they're strictly increasing because if I had any index appear twice, we get zero. Okay. Oh, yes, so the dimension, I might ask if I have a differential form as a tensor, how many components does it have? The dimension of the space is, if you think a little bit about this from the combinatorics, we have to choose k distinct elements from a set of size n, so that's, you can choose k. Okay, what are we going to do next? So if I'm working in a coordinate patch, a K-form is a tensor like omega is f I 1 a x dx I 1 wedge dx I k. And as we've seen, the independent anti-symmetric tensors are those which these indices are increasing, so we'll assume that those indices are. Okay, so we can ask what happens when we move to a different coordinate patch. Yi, we have, well, I think Giuseppe already explained how dy transforms, and it just transforms in the very simple, familiar way. Dyi is del yi del xj dxj, or I'm using the summation convention. So this is going to allow us to understand how differential forms transform as well, all we do is we insert this expression into this wedge of a bunch of dyis. So then, e.g., what happens if I have two of them, dyi wedge dyj, dyi1 dyi2, that's going to be 1 xj1 dx1 wedge and the way I figure out, I want to write this in terms of dx wedge dx, so I have to do two things. Firstly, I have to move this function out. And then you realize there's one more step. These might not be in the correct order. So when they're not in the correct order, I have to switch them. So if J1 is less than J2, then it's just this. If J1 is bigger than J2, it's minus this is the game you have to play to get the right transformations. I don't know if you can actually see the last line. Is this visible when it's high up? Okay, so maybe I can, before we move to a more complicated example of these transformations, are there any questions?
And just maybe in all our GR courses and all the coordinates always had the indices up.
Did they really?
There's no special reason, it's just convention.
I don't know why some people have the indices up and some of them have them down. I can try to put them up if you like. Any other questions? As a very useful example how these transform, let me explain one special case. What happens when k is equal to n? Well, then your differential forms only have one component. Because if I want to order my indices so that they're strictly increasing, there's only one way to do that. So it's just a function. So when I transform to a new coordinate patch, thank you. you must have dy1 wedge dyn is equal to something, some function, times dx1 to dxn. That's because in each coordinate, actually, there's only one. It's a tensor with one component. And what function is this? The lemma, the function is the Jacobian. It's the determinant of the matrix. Or this is U as an n by n matrix. In other words, when I move from one coordinates to another, my differential, my n forms get transformed by a factor of this Jacobian. This is a very useful thing because the Jacobian really tells you about the volume of a cube in different coordinate systems. So it's telling us that top forms are related to volume. Oh, and I again forgot to put my indices. Sorry. So let's quickly prove this. And after we prove it, I want to move on to some concrete geometric examples where we can see what differential forms look like. dy1 wedge dyn is dy1 dxj1 dyn dxn dxjn. So now, if we look at these expressions, you notice these j indices can't repeat. Because if I had two j indices for the same, then I would get 0. So j1, jn are all distinct. So we can really think of them as a permutation. Now, when I reorder things so that the things are increasing, you get that this is equal to sum. Implicitly here, there was a sum over j's, but now there's a sum over permutations. And I'm going to reorder things so that they're increasing. And now we find the formula for the determinant. Hang on. So in this matrix, dyi dxj, I'm taking one element in each row and column, multiplying them together, and picking up a sign. We're not going to discuss more. We're going to save this fact in the back of our minds for a little bit. And we're not going to discuss it more today. But the reason it's going to be important is, as you know, when you change coordinates in an integral, you pick up the same factor. Well, almost the same factor. When you change coordinates in an integral, you pick up the absolute value of this factor. You even pick up a positive version. And that subtly will be important. What that tells us, we ignore that subtly for now, is that differential forms are things we can integrate in a coordinate independent way. But if I have an n form and I write down its integral on some patch, that's independent of the coordinates, because when I change coordinates, I pick up the familiar Jacobian factor. So this is why, when we go a little further, differential forms play a key role in geometric theory of integration. Are there any questions? So you can see this one. Oh, that was over here. So I thought I would spend the last half an hour in. Next few minutes discussing some simple examples of differential. So let's start with a circle. There's a coordinate. Theta, where theta is equivalent to theta plus 2 pi. So from a formal perspective, we're treating things slightly differently than Giuseppe did, like slightly more general construction. Because in the way Giuseppe was doing it, you present the circle with two coordinate patches. And here I'm presenting it with one coordinate patch, but with this equivalence relation. But it's not really much different. So d of theta plus 2 pi is equal to d theta, because 2 pi is a constant. So S1, one forms on S1 are expressions f of theta, d theta, where f of theta plus 2 pi, f of theta, where this is a periodic function. Okay, this is very simple. And it's not surprising that, the tangent bundle of the circle, this question came up the other day, the tangent bundle of the circle, can't distinguish that from the real line. Because if I draw a circle, I can just draw a tangent vector at every point, the one which rotates me around. So the tangent vector is just the same as the real line. And that's what we're using to write down a one form on the whole circle. Let's do something more interesting. Let's do the Mobius. So what does the Mobius band look like? This kind of thing? But I want to think about it as were actually to construct the Mobius band out of a sheet of paper. All that coordinate theta and that coordinate t have my angular coordinate. But when I move from 0 to 2 pi, I do a flip on around the axis, the t-axis. So this is identified with that. Flip. So the equivalence relation is theta is equivalent to theta plus 2 pi when I go from here, when I glue the two sides, and t becomes minus t. So that tells us that d theta becomes d theta, so that's fine. But dt becomes minus dt. So if we want to write down a one form on the Mobius band, if the dt coefficients will have to have a different periodicity problem. Something like f of theta and t d theta plus t theta t t, where f of theta plus 2 pi minus t equal to f theta t. Okay, so let's think about a little bit about this second term. What this tells us is, let's just evaluate this. Think about g at t equals 0. This is an antiperiodic function. If it's positive, it's positive down here, then it must become negative up there. Particular g must have a zero. So we've seen the first little hint of some of topology on the Mobius band. It's not possible to write down a one form pointing in the t direction, which is everywhere non-zero. We're seeing that this tensor bundle is really not the same as a trivial. And ultimately, it's just because of this different periodicity. Okay, any questions? And I would appreciate feedback on the speed. I'm sometimes worried I'm going too slow.
Maybe. Could you explain why g picks a minus sign from, because we...
Because dt gets sent to minus dt.
Okay, I see. Yeah.
Because it's the transformation rules. E goes to minus t, dt goes to minus t.
Can you, so when you're defining a one form, it needs to go to zero at some point. It makes sense to me, but then I think it's just weird.
I mean, you think about it in terms of vectors. I have my circle here, and I'm saying it's a circle in the middle of the Möbius band, and you want to write down a vector which moves it a little bit. We're saying it's not possible to do that in a continuous way, because if the vector points up here, then must point that way there, because it to be continuous when they flip. You can think about it more geometrically if you think about it in an actual piece of paper. If I draw my, I'm not going to be able to draw it, but if I draw my circle around the core of the Möbius band, I can move, my vector is going to be something that allows me to move this line a little bit and shift it in the direction the always point. It's saying that every nearby circle must intersect this one, which you can convince yourself by staring at a piece of a Möbius band you've made out of paper. You must intersect it in an odd number of points. Let's move on to another example. I want to think a little bit about what's a one form on the sphere.
Just before moving, you made some comment about the topology. In this case, what was that? Having a function which has to take a zero somewhere.
Yes. So what we're saying, we're arguing that this bundle is not the same as a trivial bundle. In the trivial bundle, which is just the Möbius band times OR2, a section of it is given by two periodic functions, or two functions satisfying the periodicity forced by the Möbius band. And you know, they would both satisfy this relation, so I could take both of them to be one.
Yeah.
Which does not have a zero. But here we're saying it's not possible to have a section with a zero, which means it cannot be the same. It does have a section. I think about the T-sphere now. I'm going to draw it like this. It's just the usual unit ball. So what's a tangent vector? At each, it's something which assigns to each point in the T-sphere a vector in OR3. Which is tangent to it. And here, because it's the sphere, tangent means orthogonal. That E is tangent. If I draw a picture, that's P. The tangent plane looks like that. So whatever a vector field, a special type of tensor field, is at every point, I have a vector in OR3, but it points tangent to my sphere at that point. So covectors are very similar. In fact, pretty much the same as if we allow ourselves to raise and lower indices by using a metric. So we're not going to be able to prove it today, but I wanted to mention that there's a very old theorem. Is this Lefschetz's theorem, or is it older? That every vector field R one form on S2 as a zero. This is kind of a similar phenomenon. So, but to understand this, well, if we embed S2 inside of R3, you think of it as with coordinates x1. Try to use, I'm going to have to use lower indices. So I'm going to use the following trick to describe. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I was just wondering, is this related to the Harry Ball theorem?
This is the Harry Ball theorem.
It is.
Yeah, because it's, you think of your vector, having some hair on the sphere, and then there's at least one point where it's zero. I wanted to kind of get a concrete feel for why this must be true in coordinates, although proving it right now is out of reach. So what's a one form? I can write down three one forms in S2, but they're not independent because of this relation. So I'm being a little less, I think, formal than Giuseppe was, and hoping that you kind of intuitively believe that this is correct, just because we differentiate this relation, we find this relation. There is a kind of standard in the literature approach to one forms called Kähler differentials. In any case, but what does this mean? So near the North Pole, well, the North Pole is coordinates 1, 0, 0. I can always remove x1. So, and dx2, dx3 are basis. Of the cotangent. Because near there, we can say, well, dx1 can be expressed in terms of them. But of course, in fact, this is valid in the region where x1 is not equal to 0. My sphere, in the upper hemisphere, next to 3 are a basis down here, they're also a basis. On this side, So dx1, dx3 are basis, and so on. So in this way, we understand on each patch all of the one forms and how they're related on different patches by using this relation.
We just, x1 is non-zero only at the equator, right? X1 is zero only at the equator.
Exactly. I'm taking x1 to be the height.
So then, means why do we need an east-west hemisphere also? We could just say north, south, both of them, dx2, dx3 is good enough only at the...
Exactly, only... Yeah, so dx1, dx2, dx3 are good enough away from this equator. Dx1, dx3 away from this equator. And then the other equator like that.
I see.
Theater. So this covers every point in the sphere.
Okay. Also, what about means when we write things with polar coordinates, a field like d by d theta, which is always...
The polar coordinates have some redundancy, right? So if you have d by d theta and it rotates around, it's zero at this point. Because when you write things in polar coordinates, theta is not looks like theta is an independent coordinate there, but it's not. So in these very concrete terms, the Harry-Ball theorem says it's not possible find Fi dxi, which modulo the relation on one forms is non-zero everywhere. And let's just check some very simple cases. Now the most natural one forms might be dx1. dx1, if I look at my relation, this is near the North Pole. -1/(x1), x2, dx2. Plus x3, dx3. So if I look at the North Pole where x2 and x3 are zero, it's zero. And the South Pole. So similarly, the most obvious things you can write down will all have two zeros. Okay. So I wanted to explain these examples to give you kind of concrete feel in some reasonably geometric situations for what one forms look like. The next thing I'd like to explain is what's called, we've already kind of seen it, it's a little piece of algebra called the wedge product. So this I've been using the symbol dx, I wedge dxj, and so on. This gives a little more meaning to that symbol. So, the exterior power of the cotangent bundle is the totally antisymmetric tensor. If I have something in wedge K, something in wedge L, then omega 1, I can just put them beside each other. This is in the kth tensor power. This is in the lth tensor power. I can just put them beside each other. It gets something in the A plus L tensor power. I want to build from something in wedge K and something in wedge L, I want to build something in wedge K plus L. And we can do that really simply. We just put them beside each other like this and then anti-symmetrize. So we define anti-symmetrization of so in coordinates. This is very simple. You kind of trace through the notation. All it does is it's just dx I1 wedge dx ik wedge dx j1 wedge dx L is equal to, all I do is I just remove the brackets. Where implicitly we use the rules we've discussed to rearrange things so that the order of the indices is increasing. We've done this at each point, but you can make the same definition for a field that is a differential form. Suppose I have a differential form. then. Just so it's just the obvious thing. We just put them beside each other and move the functions with our mobile.
I just have another question.
Yeah, sure.
Because this was supposed to give an intuition, right, for why you have to find a zero.
Yeah, but it's it doesn't go as far as you want. It just gives you some simple examples where you see there has to be a zero. But...
And so my question is, this seems to still apply if you just look at the circle, but the
no, that's not
only hold. Dimensions. So
if I take
we still have the constraint and just
like the following vector like x2 dx3 minus 3 dx2. You're right. I mean, you're right. If I just take dx1, dx2, dx3, they'll be zero in the circle. But this expression is not.
Right. So this is constructing a counterexample.
Yeah.
Okay. But this. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So this one would still. This one would be unproblematic, but we can find one that is.
No. Yeah. Okay. So I mean, yeah, I do admit this is not. Not a great argument for the hairy ball. True, it's. I mostly wanted to see how you guys to see how you can patch things together in different. This is the abstract definition. Let's look in. So in dimension in low dimensions, you guys are already familiar with this from vector calculus. So differential forms are really just. Generalization of vector calculus to manifolds in all dimensions. So in dimension 2, I take 2 1 forms. Then omega 1 wedge omega 2, it's just. Well, you expand it out and use the rule about moving dx1 past dx2, fix up a sign. I look at the coefficient of dx1. Wedge dx2. So this dx1, that dx2 will give me a plus. This one and this one will give me a minus. So that's just epsilon ij fijj dx1 wedge dx2. Something extremely simple. In dimension 3, it's the cross product. I'll just explain this quickly and then I'll stop, if that's okay. So a 2 form will look like this. In coordinates, omega is fij dxi wedge dxj. But we can transform this into a vector. Two forms in R3 are the same as the vector fields. By using the totally anti-symmetric tensor in dimension 3. And to like that. It's a special thing about dimension 3. Totally anti-symmetric tensors in two indices, each of which in dimension 3 are the same as just one index tensor by raising and lowering things using the anti-symmetric. So in this case, if we take omega 1, omega 2, which are one forms, and omega 1 wedge omega 2, this is a 2 form, and I view that as a vector. And I also want to view this as a vector field, using a metric to raise the indices. Once I identify things with vectors, this wedge is the same as the cross product. So I'm out of time, so I won't explain why this is true, but it's really, if you remember, the formula for the cross product involves that tensor. So it's a very trivial statement. Okay, so I think I'll stop there. Are there any questions?
Generalization for Hairy Ball, can we define for tensors similar theorem instead of for?
Yeah, absolutely. It's trickier though because there's a generalization, for an arbitrary bundles in terms of the topological invariance of the bundles. So it gets a bit trickier, though, because if I have a tensor bundle of very high rank on a manifold of small dimension, it's really easy to find a section. So the question you want to ask then is, can I find some number of sections which are always independent? So we saw this in the Mobius band. We can write down a tangent bundle, a tangent vector on the Mobius band. You just can't write down two of them. You can write down one kind of pointing along the meridian. There's always a tangent vector going that way. Mobius band. You just can't write the one going this way and one going this way, which are everywhere independent. At some point, they must get aligned. And that's the kind of natural generalization.
Could you comment on the connection of this to the Euler characteristic and Betti numbers?
Yeah, the Euler, absolutely. So one wants to generalize the Hairy Ball theorem in a different way. The theorem is the following. So if M is a manifold, I don't know, you know this elementary thing you might have learned in school or something, that if you build a sphere by gluing polygons together, then you look at the number of vertices minus edges plus faces is always 2. But there's a generalization of that in any manifold. You build it by gluing pieces together, and then you count the pieces with a sign according to their dimension. That's the Euler characteristic. So then the number of zeros of a vector field, you count them carefully with some multiplicity. Is equal to the Euler characteristic. In the case of the two sphere, the Euler characteristic is 2. Do I get the impression that you guys would like things to move faster? No. I mean, I'm just wondering, is like the speed of the course okay? Yeah? Okay.
We'd love to hear more of these things, really geometric interpretations.
Yeah. I want to get to defining cohomology, which is modern way of understanding the Euler characteristic. And, oh, yeah, I'll do lots of geometric things.